Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. We are broadcasting live from the FIRE Future in Review Conference from beautiful Stein Erickson Lodge in Deer Valley.
Good morning, John. The FIRE Conference is in its 15th year. The Economist named the Future in Review Conference the best technology conference in the world. And boy, is it exciting up here. There's just a vibrancy, a buzz in the air about all of this technology, science, cutting edge, healthcare, and all kinds of interesting topics we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in the conference room where you sit down and learn about all these different things, it's not just one way, it's two way. Everybody's participating, and there's homework assignments, and there's something called the CTO challenge, which is the Chief Technical Officer challenge. But actually, most of the things that happen are during break and during dinner or breakfast as you're meeting these various people from around the world and their technologies, and you're also, you know, sharing information, collaborating possibly. It's fascinating. It's really a good program. Well, our first guest, Will Perego, he's CEO of 24-Hour Solar Roof. 24-Hour Solar Roof replaces a commercial building roof with photovoltaic panels and a watertight insulating racking system that becomes the roof. Then you add some batteries to store solar energy for 24/7 usage. 24-Hour Solar Roof delivers savings of about 35% of the construction costs of typical roofs and photovoltaic systems by eliminating the excess materials and labor that go into first building the roof and then putting the panels on. Will Perego, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
John, thank you. A pleasure to be here.
I really enjoyed our conversation last night and learning about your company. You are based in Miami.
Correct.
And you are about to have your first big test of this system in the Miami area. And then based on what you learn from that, you'll start rolling product out.
Yes, if everything goes as planned, we would have the first demo unit up and running before year's end.
So tell us about the business problem that you're trying to solve.
Perhaps there's more than one.
Yes.
So on the one hand, sooner or later, we will run out of fossil fuels, right? So then we wouldn't have any more coal, natural gas, oil, uranium to run the power plants as we run them today. and then for that, solar is the ideal technology to replace all fossil fuel technologies. And then the other aspect is it doesn't make much sense to have a solar farm in the middle of nowhere and then hundreds of miles of distribution lines to bring that energy to our homes in the cities. So the logical way will be to have distributed energy generation right on our rooftops. So then we have we are completely independent of any hurricane, anything that a terrorist attack that can bring a distribution line down, and then we don't have electricity. So that's what we do. It's not just. So now from the roof, through the 24-hour solar roof, we get all the electricity and all the water that we ever need.
This is so exciting, Will. So I don't know if you've gotten a chance to drive around Park City much, but you'll see that there are a lot of solar panels, both on commercial and residential buildings. And, you know, as we have about 260 days of sunshine here in Utah, it's a perfect market. However, when I drive home from the radio station to my house, I go by, for example, the city-owned recreation building, the PC Mark, has about 400 solar photovoltaic panels on the roof, and it's wonderful. But I've so waited to hear about a company like yours because you see the panels, and then you see this expensive roof underneath the panels, and you just wonder, when are the two going to merge? And that's what you're doing. So explain, if you will, in sort of basic construction terms how this works.
Okay, so version 1.0 of our system is a roof module, mm-hmm. Which is like 7 feet by 40 feet. On this module, we have 12 solar panels, and we ship as many modules as needed to a construction site, right? So each solar panel has a built-in battery and for 24/7 electricity. And then also on the back of the panels, there's pipes for water to circulate water to remove the heat from the panels that would make them underperform and last less. So now we get free hot water from the solar panel. So we use that hot water in the house. So we save on energy on running the water heater, but we have excess hot water. So now with a special type of air conditioner that runs on hot water rather than on electricity, we save about 80% of the energy consumption of the air conditioner. And that is, the air conditioner is about 50% of the total consumption of a house. So that's a significant savings. And while we are doing this, the roof is also collecting the rainwater. And the roof is also recycling the gray water, mm-hmm. that we used in the house. So we get water from the roof and we recycle some of the water. And then also we add an atmospheric water generator. So we get fresh drinking water from the roof powered by the solar panels. So we get all the water that we need and all the electricity that we need.
This is incredible. This is a smart roof. This roof does everything. It's not just your ordinary roof. So tell me then, so say I'm a building contractor a contractor, and I'm going to get the roof of this house I'm building to a certain point. What is that point before we can bring on your roofing module with the solar panel?
So we bring the entire roof. So we will... initially, it's only for new construction. So mm-hmm. Contractor and us should talk before you start building mm-hmm. the house or the building. And so we coordinate how your building connects with our roof. And so then there will be a date to deliver the roof to your construction site. And we arrive in the morning. With the crane, we place all the modules in place, and by the end of the day, you have electricity and water coming out of the roof.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, Lynn and I are broadcasting live from the Future in Review Conference. We're having a conversation with Will Perego, who's the CEO of 24-Hour Solar Roof. Will, the business models seem to be changing where going out on site and building a commercial building or building a residential home, increasingly people are building modules in factories and achieving certain efficiencies and then just assembling out in the field. Is this a candidate for that type of business model?
So the two markets that we envision, one is for commercial real estate. In that case, we would only ship these roof modules, right, to the construction site. The other market is prefabricated homes. So in this case, we partner with the home manufacturer. So then, and they ship the entire home in modules to the construction site. So each one module already has that section of our roof. The home manufacturer builds our roof on their home and ships everything to the construction site.
Will the owner of the commercial building or the I guess there's tenants, so there's a lot of different combinations of who would own this. But are they able to sell electricity back to the grid? Can you capture it and put it back on the grid?
Sure. That depends on the laws of the different countries or different states, right? Everywhere is different. But the roof becomes a profit center for the building owner. So then he chooses what to do with that electricity, among other things, to sell the excess electricity onto the grid, or another product that we may launch next year is to simply facilitate the trading of renewable electricity among neighbors by passing the local utility company. So if you get a better price from your neighbor than from the utility company for your electricity, then you can choose to sell it to your neighbor.
Right. So going back to the installation of this, I'm just sort of fixated on this. You're bringing these, you're bringing the roof in pieces. And so how do you achieve it being watertight?
Well, if you think of any metallic roof, it comes in modules, right?
Yeah.
So each portion is a metallic piece. So no, that's okay. The easy part.
That's the easy part. Okay.
No leaking.
So with so many working parts between, you know, recycling water, capturing gray water, pulling the heat off the panels, air conditioning, have you tested this all as one thing, or have you tested the various components of it?
All the pieces were perfectly fine separately. So now this demo roof that we should have up and running before year's end will prove that we are able to bring all the pieces together in harmony.
Will, tell us about your background and how you got involved in this.
We've been doing commercial real estate investments for a while. And one such investment was calling for a sustainable building. And we realized that the technologies that we would need to achieve to be self-sufficient didn't exist. And so as products. But then we realized that those technologies were available as intellectual property at universities and available for licensing. So then we decided to license the technologies and bring the products to market ourselves.
Okay, the big question, Will, has this been tested in an environment with snow? I mean, I know you're from Miami. You don't have that challenge here, because I'll tell you, so the solar panels I have on my house, for example, and this has everything to do with the angle of the sun in the winter, but we don't even clear the snow off the panels because it just doesn't generate the power.
Yep.
So where are you on that with snow? And
So if you think about it, the one country with most solar energy is Germany, and there is a lot of snow in Germany. So what's interesting about circulating the water is that early in the morning, if it has been snowing during the night, we can circulate hot water. So then we melt the snow automatically for you. And then your solar panels are ready to go.
Well, this is your first experience at the FIRE conference, Future in Review. How has it been?
It's a second time here.
Oh, second time.
Yeah,
okay.
But it's been a fantastic experience both times.
Okay. Is there one takeaway from this conference that really has you thinking?
Every time I walk away with a few multi-billion dollar ideas that then I don't have the time to execute. There's a favorite for me this one time, but I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so it's a new type of computer that I'm not allowed to talk about.
Oh, that's right.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Huh?
Convergent machine, or what's it called?
He's not allowed to talk about it, JW.
Well, I think the name I can say. It's called Coventry.
It's the Coventry computer. Yeah. That's it. That's it. Yeah, very exciting. And do you stay in touch with future and review attendees during the year, since you're building relationships and all?
Yeah, we've become acquaintances or even friends.
I have one more question about materials, because I know here at the Future and Review conference, there was a lot of talk of cutting edge materials, whether it's graphene or whatever. How much are the materials changing in photovoltaic panels?
I'm sure that there's a lot of things happening in laboratories.
Yeah.
Those things haven't reached the market yet.
Okay.
Well, in our case, we are also working in a better battery, it's not ready either. So hopefully next year we call it flash charge batteries, a battery that will recharge 40 times faster than a lithium ion battery.
Wow!
There you go, Lynn.
And what are the materials in that? From lithium ion to what?
Carbon based. We tried with graphene, but it hasn't worked for us, but there are other carbons that do.
Wow.
Will Perego, CEO of 24-Hour Solar Roof. Best of luck to you. Look forward to seeing you again next year. And thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, John. A pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We're going to go back to the studio for just a couple minutes to hear from some underwriters. When we return, John Hines, co-founder and CEO, and Murray Cantor, co-founder and CTO, Chief Technical Officer of a company called Aptage. And this is a conversation you're going to want to hear. So stay with us. You're listening to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Do you have gently used furniture, appliances, cabinets, or building materials that need a new home? Donate them to the Habitat Restore and help local hardworking families. You can bring your items to us or schedule a pickup at 435-658-1400. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells, and we are broadcasting live today from Stein Erickson Lodge in Park City. We're at the Future in Review conference here, the FIRE conference. Really exciting science, technology, healthcare, materials, all kinds of cutting edge companies and people here, a couple of those sitting right in front of us. Our guests are John Hines, the co-founder and CEO, and Murray Cantor, the co-founder and chief technical officer of a company called Aptage. Aptage's objective analysis enables development organizations and leadership to better communicate and control the real risks and uncertainties inherent in things like software development and innovation. We're so glad you could join us, John and Murray. Thanks for coming to Cool Science Radio here at Stein Erickson Lodge this morning.
Oh, thank you very much for having us. This is great.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's start here. John, maybe we can start with something. I know that in addition to forecasting for risk management for big projects like software development and other innovation, I want to bring it home a little bit. You know, just next door, there's a big construction project going on.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's probably small by, you know, certain standards, but it's pretty big for us. It's an addition onto the hotel next mm-hmm. door, the Golden or Hirsch. So if you're able to forecast what's going to happen in a construction project like that. This is an application for what you're doing at Aptage. Can you kind of take us through what you might do if you are part of a construction project?
Absolutely, Lynn. The way that the Aptage engine works is it understands some of the estimates and predictions that we have about the future. How long is it going to take to pour the new foundation? How long is it going to take to frame it? Those things we know some of them, but we don't know everything about them. There's some uncertainty in every one of those things. The other thing that the engine looks at is our progress. You know, how much framing did we finish yesterday helps us learn how much framing we'll finish in the next few days or weeks. What Aptage does is it gives us a risk prediction of how likely we are to finish by some deadline and with the right scope or the right features. You know, is everything going to be done and done well when we think it should be? Concretely, what that could look like is that there's perhaps a 17% chance that this construction will be finished in 6 weeks and a 92% chance that construction would be finished in 4 months. And having those two numbers, that range of things, gives us an ability to plan. When should we announce that this is going to be done? What kinds of plans do we set the stage in order to have a grand opening?
Murray, talk a little bit about project plan or super planning poker. What is that, and how do you apply it?
Well, sure. So, thank you, Lynn. Planning poker is a technique that comes out of agile software. And the idea is that a team, when you're thinking about how much effort it takes to do a piece of software, the old measure was how many person weeks it would take. And that turns out to be just not a very good measure. Mm-hmm. Writing a line of code can take 1 hour or 10 minutes, depending on how hard it's really solving the problem.
Right.
Not typing the code in. And so what agile teams do is they talk about story points, which is an estimate of just the size. In planning poker, what the teams do is they say, okay, they're looking at the story, and they'll actually put down a card, which will have a number on it, like a 5 or an 8 or a 13. They actually like those numbers for a lot, 1, 2, 5, 8, 13. And
okay.
And then what they'll have is a discussion about, if some people bid 5 and some people bid 8 and some people bid 13, they'll sit around and argue about whether it really is a 5 or really is an 8 or really is a 13. And the point is that what they end up, in some cases, they sort of talk the other people into the single number. What we do in our estimation is say, well, look, there's some chance the guy at 13 is right, and there's some chance the guy at 5 is right. And we'll take all three numbers and use that as a way to estimate what is the likelihood of them completing the work. So we take the wisdom of the whole team and the collective beliefs of the whole team in creating the future forecasts.
Wow, you're the PhD in math, aren't you, Murray?
Yes,
I tell.
How did you know?
Yeah. What was my first clue?
Yes, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with gentlemen from Aptage, John Hines, co-founder and CEO, and Murray Cantor, who is also co-founder and chief technical officer. Being a PhD in mathematics and also being an IBM fellow, Murray, you've been involved in some extraordinary projects. Over time, and to have you in this company with John, it's just a perfect combination to be able to put this application or series of applications together. But I wanted to ask you about the future. The word algorithm scares a lot of people. Are we moving towards a commoditization of algorithms where people will be able to buy off-the-shelf things that they can incorporate into their application and build products such as the one that you all have built?
Well, I wouldn't use the word commoditization. There certainly is an application economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that the idea that kind of algorithms that we have, for example, we will license to other people so they can build them into their applications. And so the applications and the algorithms that we have are very general purpose. When you're starting any project about which you don't have complete information, and the best you can do is create probabilities of what's going to happen, there's a lot of places that could happen, a lot of domains. We're working on some domains. Other companies will work on others, and we'll license that algorithm. And that's not, that's a good thing. That make, that creates a, an economy of intellectual capital, and it makes the world more efficient.
Exactly. There is a lot of traffic in Boston. And when the Big Dig project came in, there was a ton more because all this traffic was diverted. It's probably the biggest, it was one of the biggest public transportation projects in the country. It was at least, it took twice as long as they originally anticipated. It at least cost twice as much as was originally anticipated. And it impacted a lot of people like myself who had a lot of trouble getting around town, and all the businesses that ended up closing, restaurants and stuff, because people couldn't get to their places. So you're asking us to imagine an environment where you can find out ahead of time if that project's going to fail or not. In other words, you could possibly, let's just as an example, plug in all the parameters into the Big Dig in Boston, and that thing comes up and says, you got a 15% chance of this thing hitting the milestones, and then you could go back and address those areas that the software believes are problems. Is that the gist of it?
That's exactly it. At the beginning of the project, there was a whole lot that they didn't know that, that was going to happen. They made a whole lot of assumptions that were just unfounded. And then they told people and committed to those dates with no justification, created exactly the havoc you're talking about.
Right.
And our software would have found that, and we would have given people a chance to make the right adjustments.
Right. So included in this is the planning process as well, because it seems as though that's where, you know, before a project even gets off the ground, it's delayed.
Yeah, absolutely. The planning process and the execution, both of them are important for this. When we start and we have a first plan, there's some uncertainty, there's some innovation. The Big Dig was a very innovative project. It was not possible to know everything up front. And so there was natural uncertainty that was present in it. At that point, understanding how much uncertainty is there and how big of a risk that hard commitment, the original cost was adjusted to be about $6 billion. It's ended up over $24 billion. So even worse than you were hoping, John,
wow.
In terms of the cost. It was about a factor of four times more.
Oh.
Now, even if the
glad
original,
I don't live in Boston.
Well, it's good now. Everything's fine. But I tell you, it was hell for a while.
Right.
It was a wonderful civil project.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
a project management disaster.
Okay.
Yeah, lots of good outcomes from it. But the finances and the timetable were terribly managed. Now, what would be very important in that project would have been to figure out very quickly when starting it that things are not on track, and to have raised the flag very fast so that everybody knows and then can make better decisions. As it was, that was not uncovered very quickly. Things we call it hope-based planning. We hope we're going to get back on track. We're not going to raise the red or yellow flags. And because things went so long, and then it became a critical emergency, that's where this went really wrong as a project management failure. What our software does is it watches the actual execution of what's happening end the original plan and learns as it goes from what's really going on. And the risks would have not only started with significant risk on this project, but they would have gone up. You would every month, every year, the risks would have increased for this project to finish on their original schedule and cost. And that would have been very obvious.
Mm. So there is a little bit of risk management in live radio, but it's mostly intuitive. It's like, how firm do you think our guests are going to be today? Do you think they're going to show? And so I don't really know a lot about this world. So talk about the scale of projects that would require this level, this ability of software, of risk management. And, you know, what do we do now? And you know, obviously we're going where you're going with AppTage in the future. But can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. Certainly these kinds of techniques can work for any project, small and large. They make the most economic sense for multiple teams trying to work together to reach an outcome, all the way up through very large projects, like things like the Big Dig or large projects with prime contractors and subcontractors. The when it's just a few people working together, we often can make pretty good decisions about things, although these techniques help. When we have many teams working on a larger software system or an enterprise that's working with multiple teams to build some system for for a customer base. In those cases, getting the teams to work together becomes a lot harder, and our tools are especially useful there to uncover what's happening across the teams and raise issues earlier before it becomes too late to do anything about it.
One of the reasons these conversations are hard is because people are often asking each other to make commitments they can't make.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sort of forced into making a promise that you don't believe.
It's a stab in the dark.
And so rather than doing that, we let people talk to us about what their ranges of uncertainties are. And so they can have what I call the adult conversation.
Mm.
So and our tool rolls that up for
okay.
people.
Okay.
I'm curious about a funded project. This would certainly, you know, for software development or construction project, mm-hmm. you know, systems engineering. I mean, it would certainly be a great application. But what about a project that's not funded and somebody is trying to evaluate different contractors or different software development organizations to put something in? Can they use this product and predictive analysis to be able to figure out who they should go with?
Yeah, that's a great point. It's similar to the planning question mark mm-hmm. of are we using this tool for planning purposes? At proposal time, when we're thinking about something, having more quantitative measures of risk in a project can help us make decisions between proposals. So if we're looking at three contractors to renovate our kitchen, understanding their plan, understanding where they feel really confident and where they're less confident about being able to get things done helps us evaluate those proposals to help us pick either a software contractor or a kitchen contractor. The proposal itself can be analyzed. There's less information. There's more uncertainty at that stage because we haven't actually started yet, but we still have enough information to make some decisions better.
So, for example, if you're working between three contractors, and for contractor one, this is a very new idea. They haven't built anything like this before. Mm-hmm. Contractor two, this is the fourth time they've gone through this. There's a lot less uncertainty with that one.
Right.
So you can take their numbers and you can risk adjust them. And I've seen techniques where the government does this kind of thing. And our tool would help you do that. And you would understand what is the like, whether the lower bid with higher uncertainty is a better choice than the higher bid with the more experienced people with less uncertainty.
So in the private sector, we're really not that familiar with projects that are late. You know, Microsoft's trying to get their new release of Windows out or this or that. You know, we just don't know about them unless we work for the company. But certainly with the federal government, we read all the time about the fighter jet that is 8 years late and $18 billion more than they originally expected. So this is an application, of course, that the government would be able to utilize or the contractors within the government.
Absolutely. And, in fact, we already have a lead into an acquisition reprocessing that's going on with the Air Force right now, where they're looking for these sorts of techniques.
All right. So let's talk about your marketplace a bit. When did you all launch?
We've launched this year. We have we've got customers with some revenue. We've got a number of customers that are evaluating our solution as well. So we are in the software development space today. So we're available. Mostly we're integrated with Atlassian Jira, which a lot of software teams use for their project management. We also have support for Microsoft Project, which is a more structured, dependency-driven model for planning systems. We are in pilot conversations with two construction companies, one in Dallas and one in the Middle East.
Okay. So when we're talking, you know, the order of, a budget for a project, does it make it, you know, at what point is it feasible to use your tool of AppTouch?
For software development, we are priced at approximately like 1 or 2% of the budget of the whole system.
Okay.
And the value proposition with that is that if we can keep the team visibly and on track doing the right things and acknowledging and making the hard decisions to address risks when they come up, that we will keep the team from getting off track by at least that much.
Hmm.
Tell us about your future. Well, you know, we're not under non-disclosure, but are there additional products that will complement this that you'll be coming out with? Are there new areas that you're going to be going into? Where would you like to take this company?
That's a great question. We have we've got probably more ideas than we could talk about in this spot. The idea of schedule and scope management and uncertainty innovation is, of course, core to what we're doing right now. Value management, are we building the right things and how valuable will they be, is next on our roadmap and agenda. Beyond that, providing decision support for how do we make strategic investment decisions, like in the case of the extension to this hotel, is deciding between extending for that wing versus other things that that could have been done here. There were choices, there was a budget. Deciding where to apply those resources and why are part of the future of where Aptich is going to be going. Truly making strategic investment decisions and advice for executives on how to make those decisions to maximize the likelihood of really good outcomes.
Mm. So we asked Murray about his background, but we didn't ask you, John. You're a pretty young guy. How'd you get to this spot?
Well,
Murray's pretty young.
Yeah, he is, but
So
radio keeps secrets, doesn't it?
That's fine. I've earned all this gray hair.
Murray, we are experienced. That's what we are.
That's what we are. Yes.
Well, I'm in my 40s, so I'm not super young. I've been in the software development field for my whole career.
Okay.
For the past 10 years, I've been running my own consulting company, which has been fantastic. I get to do technology and process and sometimes people coaching. It's brought me to locations around the world, and I've been able to do some really interesting consulting. What brings me into Aptich with Murray is that the consulting that I was doing, while I found it to be beneficial to my customers, both to the people and to their financial outcomes, I was able to do that with individuals and teams and not at large, at massive scale.
Mm-hmm.
What we're building here is the ability to provide this as a product, as a tool for hundreds, thousands of teams everywhere. And I see it as an extension of everything that I've been building. And when Murray and I met a couple of years ago, we found that we had the same philosophies, the same approaches, and we shared complementary but very similar sets of skills to solve these problems. And that's how I'm sitting here.
All right. And is it your first time at the Future in Review Conference? And if so, what are your impressions?
It is my first time. My impression is that this is a fantastic conference. The quality of the interactions and the people is off the charts. I'm energized and exhausted at the same time, and I'm planning on coming back.
Yes, this is my second time here. Mark invited me last year to speak on the key topic of the conference, and
how did I miss that?
Really?
I did. I missed it.
We'll talk. Anyhow, this is an amazing conference, and I'm so pleased and excited to be back here again.
Yes.
And I've talked John into us becoming a fire starter.
Mm-hmm. Ah, I love it.
Yeah, I think it was a fantastic, easy to convince me, but it was a fantastic choice for us.
Yeah,
and give us, our listeners, the definition of a fire starter. Is it an underwriter of the conference? Or?
Well, what Mark and Sharon do, who are the founders of the conference, is they look for companies that they think are likely to actually make a difference in the world.
Right.
They have technologies that they see are game changers. And they invite you to be a fire starter, and you pay a not really hefty fee to do that and participate.
And there are a lot of people that don't make the cut.
Yes.
So it's a very special... Yeah, it's a special group.
It's a select group. It's an honor to be part of it.
Yes, and we have an exciting set of colleagues.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
Yeah.
John Heintz and Murray Cantor are the co-founders of Aptich. Aptich's objective analysis enables development organizations and leadership to better communicate and control the real risks and uncertainties inherent in things like software development and large-scale construction projects. Murray and John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's really been
great
a pleasure.
To have you.
It has been. Thanks.
We're going to go back to the studio for a couple underwriters, and when we return, Shane Fox and Vishal Singh, founders and co-founders of Link3D, we're going to be talking about 3D printing. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. the museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves eclectic American cuisine. Open nightly at 5:30 p.m., reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. We are broadcasting live from the FIRE Conference, Future in Review, in Stein Erickson's Lodge up in Deer Valley. Our next guest, Shane Fox, co-founder and CEO, and Vishal Singh, co-founder and chief technical officer from a company called Link3D. Link3D is an additive manufacturing software company based in New York City, focusing on software advancements for the 3D printing industry. Link3D's digital factory SaaS products allows engineering companies to create a virtual digital factory. We're going to find out exactly what that is. To manage their 3D printing workflows and all, Link3D brings security, efficiency, accessibility, and traceability to every connecting point within an organization growing 3D printing, the adoption of 3D printing. Shane and Vishal, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really good to have you here. So describe your product, and you absolutely have to tell us what digital factory means and how your company, how your products make this happen.
Yeah, sure. You want me to go?
Yep.
All right. So, you know, Linked as the company was born out of probably an 8 to 12 month long research project. So I come from a deep background in microlattice structures and the industrial 3D printing market space. And we basically just kept seeing gaps in the industry and basically customers wanting, you know, more sophisticated tools for, you know, all sorts of things related to 3D printing. And I met this guy and, you know, we started the journey and we built the company and we launched our product Digital Factory. And essentially it's exactly what you said. It's a software platform that helps engineer software speak to the application engineer's hardware, meaning the industrial 3D printers. So we're you could think of us as the connecting ground between software and hardware, and we offer a whole variance of tools that you know help our customers to achieve automation and optimize distribution of their manufacturing.
And Vishal, how did the two of you meet and begin your collaboration?
Shane describes it very nicely, but I'll take a shot. So I was at home on one Saturday evening, and he calls me and says, "Vishal, I have this idea, and I've been researching this, and we want to solve it." And I would let Shane go describe it more.
He's like, "Who is this?"
"I'm at a party. Will you leave me alone?"
Yeah, literally. He's like, "I'm who is this? I'm having dinner with my family," and I was laying in I don't know, Central Park or some park in New York City, taking photos, and I was stalking Vishal online and reading about him. I mean, he's probably the most brilliant person I've ever met. You know, he's a very accomplished writer, many patents, you know, from at Columbia University. He's worked at NEC, Motorola, and, you know, I just knew he was the right person, and I trapped him, and I cornered him in New York City on the street when we met, and I pitched him on the idea, and you know, that was 2 years ago, and we started running with it since then.
Yeah. Is he a pushy New Yorker?
not really. I saw that he has a deep background in additive industry, and Shane had already identified some of the key problems that is kind of slowing down the growth and adoption of industrial 3D printing. Like how could engineers find appropriate service bureaus and contract manufacturing partners, the kind of expertise that was needed, all of that was kind of Wild Wild West. It was like not easy to do. And that's when we decided that we wanted to take a very data-driven approach, very systematic approach, and solve the problem so that could trigger the exponential growth of industrial 3D printing adoption of that.
Yeah.
So if you're just joining us, we're at the Future in Review Conference at Stein Erickson Lodge here in Park City. We're speaking with a couple of the founders of Link 3D, which is an additive manufacturing software company. And, you know, we are a science and technology show, Cool Science Radio, but we're kind of for the science curious versus, you know, maybe more the lay people. So I want to break it down a little bit. What, first of all, additive manufacturing, does it basically mean what you can make with a 3D printer?
Yeah. Yeah. Additive manufacturing is the technical term for 3D printing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have the consumer market, right? So you can go to Home Depot or Lowe's or Walmart and you know, buy your kid a 3D printer. And, you know, you can make some toys and have some fun with it. And then you have the industrial scale. So, you know, a lot of people don't realize that they get... you might get in your car, right? And you have 3D printed parts in your car and you don't know. You could fly in a plane now, you know, that the fuel nozzles powering, you know, the entire flight are 3D printed. You know, satellites in space, you know, oil and gas rigs have 3D printed parts, you know, and my favorite, which is, you know, where I kind of started off, was the biomedical space. You know, there's over 2 million people in the world today with 3D printed implants, right? Yeah. So you hear these special cases, right? Like, oh, man gets his sternum replaced or his cranial replaced. But it's gone on an industrial scale. It's gone, you know, into like mass production now. And it's amazing.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because when we started Cool Science Radio about, 5 years ago, it was, I mean, I'm sure there was additive manufacturing far before them, but that's when I think the average person realized what a 3D printer does, and you know it's staggering. But so let's take something like a 3D printed heart valve, for example, and then let's take it through the problem or the gap that you found before when you saw the gaps that led you to create your company. So you've got, I would assume, you know, a bunch of different materials, and you've got the software written to create the product, but you've got to match up with a manufacturer, because I would assume different types of 3D printers have used different materials and specialize. And I would imagine it's not really an industry specific, like all the healthcare, you know, devices are printed in this kind and the aerospace over here. So if you could explain that a little bit, I think that would be useful. Yeah. Either one of you.
Yeah. So, you're exactly right. So, the digital factory product has two approaches. So one, essentially the first thing you do with the product is you actually install, right, through an API, your internal manufacturing capabilities. So, this is a pretty staggering number. So 41% of all industrial 3D printed parts are made with third-party vendors. That means 60% are being made in-house. So if you look at traditional manufacturing, it's the reverse and way to, you know, it's 80, 90% is made through third parties. And then, you know, a car company engineers the parts and then assembles them. But because 3D printing is so accessible and it's so advanced, companies are now bringing additive manufacturing in-house. So the first thing you'll do is you actually imagine you plug in your machines into the digital factory, and that lets us read what's going on in the machine. So is it running, yes or no? What's the queue? So how many part orders are, you know, in the line? Because what we're trying to do is help customers reduce inventory and create a true on-demand distributed manufacturing model. So getting back to your question, what an engineer will do is he'll use the traditional CAD software, right? So we don't actually provide the CAD software. So he might design this heart valve in CATIA or SOLIDWORKS or Fusion or AutoCAD, you know, whatever it may be. And then what they do is they integrate the CAD solution into the digital factory. So what we are is we're an advanced product lifecycle management tool. And once that happens, everything is automated. So it's really cool. So a lot of times, because the designs, like a heart valve, is so complex, right? And it has so many curves and it has so many different features to it, the files are typically bad for 3D printing, right? So it's called a STL, stereolithography file. It's triangles. And what we do is we analyze it and we autonomously repair it. So we actually make the part from not printable, literally, to printable. It's that simple, right? So we do a full analysis of the part and give you a report. Then what happens is that part is then routed through our system to the appropriate machine. So an engineer, literally, all he has to do is upload the part and everything else happens. So what we're doing is we're reducing build failure. We're also bringing automation. So we reduce, you know, human error as well. And we route it into the correct machine based on the parameters and the lead time because we know the capacity of the machine. And we also, you know, you could tell us, okay, our distribution's in Holland, but we're an engineering company in Utah. And you may not have an internal facility. We can route it to one of your certified vendors, or you could find a vendor through our network in Paris, right? So you're achieving true distributed manufacturing, right? So you're saving on logistics. And, you know, it's great for sustainability reasons, right? You know, flying or driving, you know, trucks, CO2 emissions, the whole nine yards. It's a digital file. You just send it through to a printer. The printer prints it. And it delivers from Paris to Holland. And that's a lot of the cases that our customers are doing.
So for the in-house customer, and it might be like a General Electric that's building a jet engine, they'll be able to use this service, of course. But the smaller customer that does not have its own in-house capability, it's like a service bureau. They can go out and they can access printers and they can access applications and they can get assistance. So it helps them to keep their costs down as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want me to go?
Shaw doesn't want to talk. He's still sleeping.
Shaw, you're looking good, brother.
Thank you.
So actually, kind of two-part back to both of your questions. So we have also built, as a side fun project that was fun, we built the world's largest digital supply chain. So we have almost 200 industrial-grade service bureaus in our network, which gives us access to all their machines and capacity. So you know, if you can't afford the machines or you're worried about obsolescence, you submit the parts to the network, and we help you find a bureau or a third-party vendor or service bureau that can actually build the parts for you.
Shane Fox, co-founder and CEO, and Vishal Singh, co-founder and chief technical officer from Link3D, a fascinating company here at the Future in Review conference. Go to link3d.com.
.co.
.co.
We're techie.
Oh, I like that. Hey, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science
Cheers.
Radio.
Thank
we
you.
Are going to go back to the studio to play a couple of remaining underwriters, and we want to thank everyone for joining us on our remote show on Cool Science Radio today. Back to you, Bob.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you. NPR News coming up next. Thank you for listening to KPCW Park City. Our forecast today, a high of 53. Currently, we're at 39 degrees here in Old Town. And we're ready to go back now to NPR News.